technology is a trap sometimes, which is that we first use technologies to solve a problem that we think exists. Then we have created a bunch of artifacts of that technology. And finally, we have to create new technologies to solve the problems of the artifacts of the technology.
Welcome to Let's Talk Change. Human history is a long series of adaptations to disruptive change. The impact of innovation and scalability of today's technologies is powerful. They either deteriorate or improve living conditions on Earth. In this podcast series, we sit down with decision makers, innovators, experts, and visionaries to discuss how technologies, business innovations, policies, and improved communication can drive the change we need to amplify sustainable behavior in business and politics for the benefit of the people and the planet.
We have today the director of the Building Lab at the Yale School of Architecture, who is also working closely together with Professor Schnellenhuber at Bauhaus der Erde, Ellen Organski. Welcome to our podcast. And we have, which is also a kind of special occasion, that we have two guests on a show, but we also have Emanuel Heisenberg, who is the founder of EcoWorks, a CO2-free renovation company based in Berlin. And welcome both on the show today. And I will start with you, Ellen. First of all, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the combination of your work at the Yale School of Architecture and the Bauhaus der Erde, and how this all fits together and what exactly you do there.
Sure. It's a sort of intertwined question answer. So I'll try to summarize it briefly. So I was trained as a Tischler cabinet maker and builder and went to architecture school to try to professionalize my work. And from there went to school, graduated, and started immediately a design build company, Gray Organsky Architecture, which produces building components, designs buildings, et cetera, ranging a whole range of things. And I was asked to teach at Yale, invited to teach at Yale about 20 years ago, and started there teaching design studio, and very quickly took over a design build program, which was essentially first year graduate students, advanced degree students, who were designing and building houses for homeless families. All over the course of 9 months. So over 22 decades, perfecting that process to try to engage community participants and really open up the process, but also give students really direct experience in how to manufacture a building. And that turned into a big research project about a material that's close to my heart, which is wood, and how that might actually serve to be a tool to mitigate climate change rather than increase climate change. And we started studying life cycle impacts of materiality and our consumption through the building sector. And that led me to writing a paper with a climate scientist and an industrial ecologist and a forester called Buildings as a Global Carbon Sink, which was published in 2020 in Nature Sustainability. And that led to a collaboration with John Schellenhuber through the Bauhaus Earth, which is a sort of reestablishment of the Bauhaus philosophy, but exploring not just the continental cataclysm of a world war, but rather this new climate cataclysm that we're facing, climate change, and all of the effects that the building sector have on that.
Do we have actually solutions to mitigate that?
Technologies, the so-called sustainable technologies that have been applied globally now, but mostly in the more advanced economies of Europe and America, have focused on a very specific phase of the building life cycle, which is the minute a consumer occupant walks in the door of the building, turns the key and turns on the lights and the air conditioning or heating until the day they shut the building down. And so we've really focused on making our buildings super efficient, thermally, in terms of air infiltration, energy consumption, et cetera. That's been great. It's really important. What we've missed is all of the impact that happens right at the beginning of the building life cycle, which is extracting materials, raw materials from landscapes with all the ecosystemic effects of that, negative impacts, loss of biodiversity, removal of valuable biological soils, et cetera. Through the manufacturing processes, we consume water energy, minerals. We emit carbon. We emit a lot of other toxins through manufacture of different kinds of components that are typically used in buildings, steel, plastic foams, concrete, cements. All of those impacts happen right at the beginning of the building life cycle. Right now, when we build for 2.5 billion people in the coming three decades, we'll be emitting a lot of stuff right at the beginning of the building life cycle. And it will take a long time for even quite efficient buildings to repay those impacts. And what we're trying to do is focus on exactly what we do, what we can do immediately to reduce CO2 emissions. And so that's been a focus.
So you're talking about buildings that we're going to build.
Buildings that we're going to build and or renovate, or we have to account for those initial impacts. And those are the technologies I'd like to talk about, because there are many experts talking about solar photovoltaic cells, ground source heat pumps or air source heat pumps, all of those kinds of, technologies, carbon capture, those things will take a really long time to mitigate the impacts we're talking about.
We cannot afford, economically, to have all that waste. B, with the resources problem and the value chain problem, which is another issue that we haven't even addressed here, that we cannot afford to continue business as usual. And how far do you think we are away from a concrete kind of planning that we do things differently in the construction and in the building sector?
Once we start to trickle down into professional practice, of design, engineering, and architecture, or in the general building industry, the constructors, I think what you see is a sharp fall off of awareness around these topics. And I guess just to try to define what that topic is a little more, I would say, first of all, in response to your idea about technology, I think technology is a trap sometimes, which is that we first use technologies to solve a problem that we think exists. Then we have created a bunch of artifacts of that technology. And finally, we have to create new technologies to solve the problems of the artifacts of the technology. I think in order to solve this global problem as quickly as we can, especially through this big emitter, as John Schellnhuber would say, the elephant in the climate room, a metaphor which I'm not so comfortable with because I like elephants, is that we can no longer seek to reduce to be 100% less bad, as Bill McDonough would say. What we need to do is find ways in which the activities of the building sector actually can promote and enhance biodiversity, can improve soils, can do all the things that we have typically destroyed through our extractive processes. So what it is we're looking at is not what technology do we now apply to building, but rather, what can building do to solve the problems that we've created in the earth? Literally, the materials that we choose could, if we do it right, promote forest growth, restoration, promote biodiversity, improve soils, reduce heat gain, urban heat islands. Right? I could make a list could be miles long, and some of them feel very, very aspirational and idealistic, but could be done. And others, like the use of biological materials in building, which store carbon if handled properly in the processing and the extraction, which could restore forests. These are ready at hand approaches. I wouldn't even call them technologies. We can build right now in Europe already. We're building with timber. And if we do it right and we use the right tree species and we work closely with foresters who are managing the ecologies silviculturally, then we can actually be a regenerative building sector rather than a sustainable or extractive building sector.
Do we have enough wood?
So we're working on this topic really closely, because that was the first question that we raised when we proposed buildings as a global carbon sink, which has huge political, economic impacts, et cetera. I would say if we continue to treat forests in an extractive mindset, we will not treat them well and we'll lose forests as carbon sinks, as well as valuable ecosystems. What foresters and forest silviculturists have come to understand is that there are ways to draw fiber out of forests that reflect natural disturbance. That's the goal. Forests die and live, and there's natural mortality in forests. Rather than choosing monocultures of single species that we then plant more of, how could we actually understand the dynamics of forest growth and mortality and start to become more responsive in the development of structural products to produce really dense, perhaps polycentric cities, to renovate our existing buildings, and use those analytic tools that are the true technologies that we have now and knowledge bases that we have now to create a more responsive urban building sector, to create more housing, more dense cities that reduce land consumption, that promote forest growth. That is already happening. This is already happening in places around the world. And I can cite them among our partners in the Innovation Lab Network at Bajos del Erda. And the danger, of course, is that we just say, oh, wood, this is the new bonanza. Now we're going to cut down a bunch of trees and we're going to build buildings with them. If we don't have a responsive relationship between the source supplies and the consumer demand, we will not succeed. And that's one of the new paradigms, I think, of regenerative building, that relationship.
Exactly. I mean, I think the question is not, can we tear down all the existing buildings and build everything from scrap with massive wood? I think there will definitely be not enough wood. The vision here is to create carbon sinks for the next 50 to 100 years where we can store the carbon which the trees extract from the atmosphere. And if we have trees at the end of their life cycle and then we give them another, you know, 50 to 100 years to store the carbon and not burn the trees or let them rot, you know, this is extremely important.
How you can actually turn a building into a carbon sink.
Yeah, I can give you an example. I can give you several examples, but and it's not just our work. It's people doing it around the world, literally now. We're working on a project in New Haven, Connecticut, which is a historically stressed, socioeconomically stressed neighborhood. We're building an affordable housing project, only four stories, but with 70 units for a historically Black community in that city, which once had a very strong Black middle class, but that's been really struggled since the flight of industry. We worked with a community development group and a national affordable housing developer, and we made the argument that not only would we, to the city, to the community, to the developers, to the funders, all of them who were sort of like, why would we build with these building with these new materials? We argued, first of all, that there were health benefits to wood buildings. Interior air quality was improved. We could show that. We could make an argument about true carbon neutrality, because we could literally measure how much wood fiber and therefore how much carbon was stored in that building. And over a life cycle of a 100-year life cycle, which was the minimum plan requirement, that carbon storage from those forests would be, and I'm talking about net carbon storage, so not just the amount of wood, but the amount of wood minus all of the manufacturing emissions and transport emissions that go along with it, and the sustainable FSC certified management of the forests. We could show that we had a net carbon storage, which would reduce the operational impacts, which were very low because we were using a lot of renewable energies and ground source heat pumps, et cetera. We could show that we were actually starting as carbon negative, or I should say carbon positive. We were holding carbon out of the atmosphere for X number of years until that building was torn down. And the city of New Haven, you'll be interesting to know, realized the benefit of this and offered us a zoning incentive. We were able to add more units to the apartment building because we could show that that would have no negative effect on the environment. So that's happening. And we can quantify that through simple carbon assessment measurements, and we look at them systemically. And I think that's the point that we really need to understand, that there are the alternatives for which we're substituting are significantly stressing the environment. So if we were to build that building out of concrete or steel, we would have none of those benefits. And I don't mean to get in trouble with my friends in the concrete industry, because the concrete industry is working really hard to try to cure themselves of this emissions problem. But the fact is that right now we have to answer immediately with materials at hand. And so we're able to do that. And this is goes back to your earlier question about how much wood do we have. If you ask the timber industry to justify all of its, or the timber building sector to justify all of its impact and costs to forests, then you also have to look at the alternative if we don't use this wood. And we have to start to weigh both of those options, because the alternatives could be a dead end. timber, if handled properly, could be something of an answer. And so, again, it's a systems thinking problem, which is many people in your podcast, your audience members will understand. It's how wide do you make the system boundaries when you make these analyses?
Emmanuel, Alan just pointed out a good example in New Haven, but do we have something like this in Europe? And I know you're working on quite a few projects, and maybe you can explain how you are applying basically the whole materials side in your processes.
I mean, a super nice example of in Europe is the frame houses, the Fachwerkhäuser in Germany, where they have carbon sinks for the last 1,000 years, and they are stable and nice houses. I mean, we really did a thorough life cycle assessment of a project where we actually had a GDR type Plattenbau, and we looked at the options, and we looked at what would happen if we just, you know, tear it down and build a new house, an average house, and where we do a normal renovation or conventional renovation and a serial renovation from wood. And what we found out, if you deduct the photovoltaics, because photovoltaic is always has a lot of, you know, energy stored, and of course the new buildings also need the photovoltaics in the future. So if you cut that out, the serial renovation is 50 to 100 times more CO2 efficient than the new build. So this is really like not 20-30% better, but it's really a huge factor. And actually, the serial renovation from regional regenerative wood is also 3 times more CO2 efficient than just extracting any kind of wood, which you can buy on the market without an FSC certification. You know, so it's also very important that you get kind of the right wood model into this renovation market.
What are the next steps in order to really start this transition?
Okay, I would start by saying cities must stop being antagonists to forests and other natural systems. We have to invest in nature because it is a fundamental infrastructure for us.
And stop being friendly to cars.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that would be the next step. To start to think of what transformations exist in the way we plan spaces and physical structures that would create more convivial density, that would create soil, impervious soil, healthy soils and ecosystems within our cities that connect to hinterland ecosystems to produce a smaller, effective, you know, metaphorical footprint and literal footprint of cities, to use brownfields, to think really carefully about how the material selections we make could incentivize forest restoration rather than deplete it, right? So the list is really long and complex, but it really will require some democratic processes where people are involved in making decisions about their life cycles rather than being enslaved, I'm using a strong term, by the path dependencies that capitalism creates for us. So one of the path dependencies that we have that Emmanuel just mentioned was, you know, we have these plastic materials that are ready at hand. We've subsidized their manufacture. We've sunk costs in developing the manufacturing technology that will produce them, the transport systems. We've justified everything around these paths that represent extractive approaches to making things, anything, any consumer product. So for me, it's looking at those processes, taking them apart. And that's what architects and engineers are really good at, dismantling structures and putting them back together. And the structure in this case is how we build cities. And to think of like where we can give incredible benefits by simply the act of making. So I'll give an example of a path dependency. A car requires a certain amount of space. We allow them through the networks of our cities. That takes over the pedestrian ways. These are all things that we've been talking about for 50 years at least. So imagine changing something, not just changing the technology of the internal combustion engine to the electric battery driven vehicle, but to say, what if the vehicles were different? Maybe it's mass transit. Maybe it's the electric bicycle. What would be the spatial implications for making cities and what architects would think about if we were to change something like that? Now, that's a long way down the road. And I know we have transitional questions and behavioral issues around how we consume materials and use space. But I think if I were teaching, if I were in charge of a curriculum, I would stop teaching sustainable technologies and start teaching basic systemic thinking around the spaces and the resources that we consume and the waste we generate. And from that unfold a lot of co-benefits, social enfranchisement, new employment opportunity, better performing buildings that are healthier for us, less vehicular traffic. I mean, all of these things start to unfold. And, we don't have time in the podcast to do that. But again, it will require us to think about what the spatial and material implications of the decisions we make are. That's fundamental. We have to work in synergy with one another globally. We have to think beyond political boundaries. And I don't know how that happens. Those will be the biggest barriers, I think. We have to think way ahead of past policies and their slight renovation into really strong policies that address the scarcity of resources. And the problem with it is, just to conclude this ramble, is that in a regime of economic scarcity, the people who hold the resources are going to have to give up their control of resources. And the people who don't have them are going to have to understand that they don't get to just have all those resources back. It's going to be really hard to have people give up their resources. And that's really what Emmanuel's describing. It's a relinquishing of abundance and a shift to a more scarcity economy and understanding how those systems interplay. How that's managed from a political standpoint is going to be a Nobel Prize winning solution.
Well, I mean, we have nothing to lose, do we?
No.
I mean, it's like that argument I hear a lot is, and I'm thinking to myself, it's like, what do we have to lose? We're very bad. The housing sector, construction sector, like that should be priority number one now on the list of political stakeholders. That is not a no-brainer, actually.
Yeah, I mean, you have a sector like the construction and building sector, which emits like 38% of the emissions, CO2 emissions, but has like more or less no progress in the last decades. So it's really more or less the hardest to decarbonize. And I think, coming back to your question, what PropTech can add to that, and I think Alan is doing that on his lab as an NGO, and I understand also my company as a private NGO, which also has a lab and tries to come up with technologies to scale them. And I think what the difficulties for the policymakers is, Ursula von der Leyen says, okay, let's do a renovation wave and let's, increase the rate of wood construction from less than 10% to, 30 or 50% or so. There's no data available, for example, on the existing building stock. I mean, how can you start with strategies if you don't know how the building stock looks like? And nobody, starts to scan the buildings. And the data which are available are private and expensive. So, and there's so much room for technology investment and labs, and we are just the front runners, but we also need the big industry players to invest billions in the business case to decarbonize the largest asset class in the world, residential housing. I mean, it's insane that a micro company like mine, with a now 100 people, or even if we scale to 5,000 people, it's still like a super small players in comparison to this huge opportunity, but also to the huge challenge of decarbonizing this huge asset class.
What exactly are you doing in Bhutan?
Bhutan is a very small country with 750,000 people, and they have right now about 71% forest cover in the country. And so they've been rightly recognized as stewards of forests and good government. However, they're facing the pressures that the world is facing, which is that populations are urbanizing. The valleys that are the city regions that are populated now are growing fast. They have housing shortages, and they're using fossil hydrocarbon fueled processes to produce mineral based construction systems, reinforced concrete frames, using labor force, as I said, that's not domestic, and thereby the construction industry costs a lot, but it doesn't contribute to the national economy, which is a really sad thing. And they're building buildings that, as I mentioned earlier, will be stranded assets very quickly. Poor performing buildings, leaky, and the government recognizes, the king especially. And so he has initiated an enormous project to transform the building economy and to take advantage of these resources while protecting the constitutionally mandated forest cover of 60% of the country must remain forested by constitutional mandate, which is amazing. Well, we were asked to go in and talk with them about how to develop a bio-based building industry that protected the forests, but used them in, made working forests healthier, more biodiverse, and to develop industries that could use a range of different forest fibers to produce the kinds of construction systems that can be used to make multi-story building in cities. So we're looking a lot at mass timber, cellulose insulation systems, and working with across the sector, starting from foresters through industrial manufacturers, through teachers and of professions, and actually primary school educators as well, and talking about public policy and public participation and reskilling workforces and dealing with finance, et cetera. And so working with Arup, a big engineering firm, working with the Climate Smart Forest Economy Program, the ministries of forestry, agriculture, housing and human settlement, public works, and trying to create this big network of thinkers around this problem and designing the ways in which the different work packages and the way in which the R&D process can exchange information across disciplines that have been generally siloed and separated from one another. And it's been a really interesting problem, but I will say that the support that we're getting from the government and the ethical motivation that's underpinning the project has been really astounding. And we're just getting going with our first pilot project on the primary commercial street in Thimphu, the capital of the country, and hope to model really good behaviors all along the value chain in doing so.
I think we're wrapping it. I think it was really good. I think thank you both for your time. Thanks for the insights and also kind of the looking outside the box view, which I think is really important and also the key for most people. And I hope we talk again in that kind of round. So thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you'll join us next time on Let's Talk Change. We are proud to be powered by DWR Eco, an international clean tech consultancy for business strategies, communications, and public affairs.